Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast number 156, recorded Monday, October 14th, 2019. This is the podcast giving the voice to the traveler. It's more about the journey than the destination. The topic on this edition of the Travel Commons Podcast, keeping flyers happy. We're talking to the author of the J.D. Power 2019 North American Airport Satisfaction Study. So coming to you today from the Travel Commons Studios in Chicago, Illinois, in the middle of what looks like is going to be sort of a six-week run of solid travel. So over the past 3 weeks, traveled to D.C., Charlottesville, Virginia, and Nashville in that order since the last episode. Heading back to Charlottesville this week, and then a week of vacation, hopscotching through the Baltics with my son Andrew, Riga, Latvia, Tallinn, Estonia, Helsinki, Finland, and then probably back down to Charlottesville when we get back. I flew Southwest on these non-Charlottesville flights into D.C., Reagan, and Nashville, and then United again to Charlottesville. The Southwest flights went, quite honestly, very smoothly, except for trying to get to Chicago midway for that D.C. flight. The Uber driver, you know, didn't follow the app's recommended route. Instead, he pretended he was a cab driver and took the normal route down the Stevenson Expressway, which happened to be crawling due to an earlier accident. Quite honestly, I wasn't paying attention. I mean, this is the first time I've had an Uber driver sort of freelance on me, and I didn't notice that he'd skipped the exit to the faster path that the app was recommending. I didn't pick that up until it was too late. We made our flight, but not without a bit of a hustle through Midway. No tip, let alone a five-star review for that guy. Now, Southwest flies into the old Terminal A at what, quite honestly, I still call Washington National Airport. I went to college in D.C. in the early 80s before it was named for President Reagan, and that was when Terminal A was pretty much all that was there. And so this trip, I had quite honestly forgotten or put out of my mind what a long schlep it is from that terminal to the metro station, to the subway station. I remember way back when I was in school, asking someone why they built the metro station that far away. The answer, well, because they're going to build the new terminals right across from the station, which they finally did some 20 years after that metro station opened and way after I'd left D.C. I tell you, sometimes it seems that airport planning horizons aren't in years or even decades. I mean, it feels like they're planning in, you know, the unit of measure is lifetimes. Now, in between those really non-dramatic Southwest flights, my United flight continued the string of disruptions trying to get into or out of Charlottesville. So this time, I checked that my flight was on time before calling an Uber. No weather delays at either end. United and FlightAware apps say the inbound plane is on time. But then, halfway to O'Hare, I get a text from United. A 2.5-hour delay for crew arrival. I mean, what? And then the next text right after that, because of crew scheduling disruption this evening in Chicago, we've assigned your flight a new crew. We know this delay wasn't in your plans today, so we appreciate your patience. I mean, no shit that a 2.5-hour delay wasn't in my plans, especially when it's because United stole our original crew because they screwed up their scheduling. And really, United, you can't find another pilot in O'Hare, which is your largest hub. I'll tell you what else is not in my plan, and that's flying United to Charlottesville this week. So, following up. So that's the sound of my new Marriott Bonvoy Lifetime Titanium Elite card. I'm not sure I get any more adjectives in there. Anyhow, that's the card hitting the kitchen counter. The mailer package that it came in was appropriately upscale, as all these tend to be. But I have to tell you, the sheer weight of that card just stunned me. I put a quick video, actually, where I got the sound from, is from a quick video that I put up on the Travel Commons Facebook page. Kate Rose commented under that. She said, "Hope it scans into your store card app so you don't actually have to carry it and have it count against your luggage allowance." Kate, that was my thought exactly. Now, I got a note that Chicago's electric scooter pilot ends tomorrow, Tuesday, what is that, October 15th. Sorry, I'm losing track of dates. But anyhow, which made me realize that I've seen these electric scooters in just about every city I've been this summer. So Budapest, Krakow, Charlottesville, Nashville, Washington, D.C., as well as Chicago. I think the only places that I haven't seen them were in Scotland and Ireland. I find the scooters, they're handy because they're dockless. They have a wider distribution. They're easier to find than, say, traditional docked bike shares. And you can take them directly to your planned location. You can just leave them as opposed to then trying to find a dock that you can, you know, or a place that you can redock it. And I think they're a good fill-in, at least for me. They're a good fill-in between walking and, say, an Uber or Lyft. And hey, they're fun. When I was in D.C. a couple weeks ago, I was in the Brookland neighborhood, which is up in northeast D.C. It's where I went to college. And actually, there's a new tap room there, Right Proper Brewing. That's a good name. And I wanted to try it out. Now, I have to tell you that Brookland is not the nicest part of D.C. Now, it's much better than when I went to school there, but there are still some iffy parts. And so I wasn't completely comfortable walking down to Right Proper Brewing from the Brookline Metro stop. But I have to tell you, it just seemed too short for an Uber ride. And there was no other mass transit. Like, there wasn't a bus that went down there because it was sort of tucked away. But there was a scooter a couple of blocks from that Brookline Metro station. And running down 9th Street at 10 miles an hour, I have to tell you, it felt a little bit better, maybe a little, I was a little bit more comfortable than having to speed walk at 4 miles an hour. And I could leave it right in front of the tap room. It was exactly what I wanted. Now, there's two problems that I've seen with these scooters over the past summer. First, too many people riding them on the sidewalk, and especially when I was in D.C. that weekend. Maybe it's because I bike a lot in Chicago. I'm comfortable in bike lanes and navigating around cars on the street and keeping my eye out for potholes. I actually wouldn't be comfortable riding a scooter on the sidewalk. I'd be afraid of popping some pedestrian who suddenly walked in front of me. To me, cars are much more predictable than pedestrians. And the second problem for me is, quite honestly, the need to have half a dozen scooter apps on your phone. In Chicago, there are 8 scooter companies in addition to Uber and Lyft's scooters. And you need to download their apps, each one of them, to be able to find and rent their specific scooter, which meant that when I wanted to find a scooter near the Brookline Metro stop, I'd have to cycle through 5 or 6 different apps, except I didn't, because I had found an app called Scooter Map. And I'll put a link to Scooter Map in the show notes. And anyhow, Scooter Map shows all the scooter brands and their location on one map. I think it's targeted at folks who are making money going and collecting and recharging the scooters. I'm not quite sure how that works, but for me, it worked fine. I fired it up and saw all the different scooters that were near me and then found the closest one. Now, one caveat about the whole scooter thing, I've only ridden these scooters on sunny days. I'm not sure if I'd be quite this enthusiastic if I was riding them in rain or snow. Now, for this Baltics trip coming up next week, Andrew and I are taking Finnair out and back from Chicago, an early morning ferry ride from Tallinn to Helsinki, and then Air Baltic everywhere else. Which then got me thinking about luggage sizes, because I bought my current bag, the Victorinox Verx 22-incher, and I got it specifically to use every last inch of U.S. carry-on allowance. Indeed, it even catches a bit of side-eye from American and United gate agents when I'm walking by, and hey, I got status with those airlines. So I didn't figure that taking the Victorinox was going to work. I didn't figure it would fit into any European budget carrier's luggage sizer. And looking up AirBaltic's carry-on allowance, the bag is a couple of inches too tall and about an inch too deep. But what really got me shopping for a new bag for this trip was the weight. AirBaltic has an 8-kilogram, 17.5-pound weight limit. Now, back in episode 121, I talked about sort of this baggage striptease exercise that I had to go through with Wow Air to be able to make their 7-kilogram, 15-pound carry-on weight limit. I'd take my bag off the scale, pull some clothes out, zip the bag back up, put it back on the scale, still too heavy. So, you know, kind of rinse and repeat three more times until that agent either took pity on me or just got tired of me and gave me the approval tag to put on my bag. After which, I walked about 10 feet, opened the bag up, and put that armful of clothes that I had pulled out, put them right back in the bag. It just seemed silly, and I wasn't looking forward to repeating that. And my Victorinox is actually a bit over 7 pounds, just empty. So not only is it too tall, but the bag itself uses now 40% of that weight allowance. And even though I've talked about how much I hate shopping for luggage, I just figured I had to find a smaller, lighter bag that wouldn't cost a fortune. I didn't want to spend a lot on it because, look, the Victorinox is still going to be my primary bag. So I ended up landing on the Travel Pro Max Light 5. My daughter Claire has had a pretty good history with the Travel Pro bags. And yeah, when I looked at it online, it fit the AirBaltic dimensions and it was actually one of the lighter bags that I saw. It's 5.4 pounds, which now has it down to about 30% of that 8-kilogram weight allowance. And it also meets three of the key suitcase criteria that I laid down in my How to Shop for a Suitcase topic back in episode 137. First, it's black. Second, it's a two-wheeler, so no lost space with extended spinner wheels. And three, the inside, for the most part, is a wide-open box without, say, clothes hangers or a bunch of zip compartments. And finally, it was only $112 on Amazon. I'm taking it to Charlottesville tomorrow for a shakedown cruise before the Baltics, so we'll see how it plays. 3 years ago, back in episode 125... seem to be going way back in the archives here. In a travel security tip, I talked about the need to delete your phone's Bluetooth pairing when you return a rental car. I mean, usually when I go to pair my phone, I actually first go through and delete, I don't know, anywhere from 3 to 5 pairings before pairing my own. And they all have sort of personalized names like Timmy's iPhone. And most phones actually by default will download your contacts to the car when paired. So if you don't delete that pairing, you end up leaving all of your contacts and phone numbers in that rental. As you can imagine, this is just bad in so many ways. And now actually Hertz has gotten around to noticing it. In their latest rental terms and conditions, they specifically carve out any liability from you leaving a Bluetooth pairing behind. Look, it's a pain to remember, especially if you're running late for a flight. But as you're taking that last scan around the car for your sunglasses and iPhone, remember not to leave your identity behind either. And hey, if you have any travel stories, questions, comments, tips, rants, the voice of the traveler, send them along, text or audio comments to comments, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com. You can always leave a Twitter message to M. Peacock, post your thoughts on the Travel Commons Facebook page like Kate Rose did, or the Instagram account at Travel Commons, or you can post them on the website at travelcommons.com. The topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is keeping flyers happy. A couple of weeks ago, J.D. Powers released their 2019 North American Airport Satisfaction Study. The headline, North American Airports Struggle to Keep Travelers Happy Amid Construction Delays and Surging Passenger Volumes. It caught my eye, so I reached out to the study's author, Michael Taylor, to dig into it a bit more. And so, as it turned out last Friday, Michael and I got on the phone together. We had a pretty wide-ranging conversation. I was going to edit it down, but as I listened to it, I couldn't think about what to cut. It was a good conversation. So here it is in its entirety. On today's Travel Commons podcast, a special guest is Mike Taylor. Mike is the travel intelligence lead with J.D. Power. They've just actually last month released their 2019 North American Airport Survey. Mike, thanks for joining us on the Travel Commons podcast.
You're quite welcome.
So, Mike, the headline that came out with last month's release said that traveler satisfaction has stalled amid volume increases and construction delays. And quite honestly, linking the two makes sense to me. Actually, I was in Nashville yesterday, a city that's growing by 80 to 100 people per day, if you believe their publicity. So sort of threading through all the construction at that airport made a lot of sense. Actually, in the press release, you say that there's a light at the end of the tunnel, though. What makes you optimistic that things are going to improve?
Well, the recent history of airport improvement in North America really has one big impact point, which was September 11th of 2001, when we had the terror attacks in the United States. And at that point, you know, we had a very similar kind of economic situation. Airlines were making money, the economy was going along well, and taxpayers and politicians were willing to finance or float bond issues for, you know, major infrastructure improvements. And those all included airports. But after September 11, 2001, everything shifted quite dramatically. And the airlines started losing money. And for the last 5, 6, 7 years, airlines have started making money again. And they could put the brakes on any spending on almost any airport in the United States, simply because they know that the cost of improvements is somehow going to come back to them, because those bonds have to be paid back or investments have to be repaid, et cetera. So now that they've been making money, they've kind of allowed more construction to happen. And as you know, with your experience in Nashville, is it doesn't happen overnight. It takes a good long time. And Atlanta Hartsfield, for example, their plan for improvement, construction plans, are in the 15 to 20 year range. So that airport will be under construction in some way, manner, or form for the next 15 to 20 years.
Well, that's something to look forward to.
Yes, it is.
So when I think about this, when I looked at the rankings and clicked into the survey, you had it split between mega airports, large airports, and I think medium-sized airports.
Correct.
And so just to unpack this a little bit, I'd like to compare two airports in the mega category, the top performer, which was Detroit Metro, and the one of the bottom performers, third from the last, Chicago O'Hare. So, you know, just quickly, first of all, what makes an airport mega?
Well, when we look at the data, we track around 62 to 64 airports every year. And we look at the data that, that's common among groups, and we thought that would be best. We started off with two groups of airports, large and medium, I think was the two category names. But it became very clear to us after examining the data that those airports that are above 30 million passengers or so face quite a different set of circumstances. And certainly Detroit Metro and O'Hare fall into those categories. Most of it has to do with access, being able to actually get to the airport and park your car and get into the building itself. A very common theme among mega airports is difficulty in actually reaching the airport. Now, whether it's construction or it's traffic or construction on the roadways and DOT, those all have kind of major impacts on satisfaction, because you got to have time to get through TSA and then enjoy what the airport is offering, because most airports are enhancing their food, beverage, and retail programs across all the airports in the United States above the top 100 or so. So medium airports, very easy to get to. They're usually in, you know, relatively small towns or cities, small cities. And then compare those with Chicago or Detroit or Boston or New York or Los Angeles, which happens to be the worst as far as access, and is going to get worse when they start their construction this year.
I think access is an interesting theme there as far as just the hassle of getting to an airport, especially some of the stories that came out of New York after LaGuardia started their construction.
And that's my home airport, actually. That's the airport I use most often. I try to avoid using it.
My sympathies.
But yes, basically because everybody's phasing in and out of construction there. They've got all these various plans that are revolving on the inside and the outside of the airport. And so we're going to see this churn in the rankings quite a bit in the next few years as these projects phase in and out. You know, Chicago O'Hare is going to phase in their major renovation project. They finally decided who was going to be the lead architect for that. You know, and it's going to be, the current plan is to make it look like it's something out of Logan's Run, you know, where it's this huge canopy over the entire space, you know, which is something they actually need to do because their biggest problem is, you know, 30, 40 years ago when Helmut Jahn designed those terminals, they were kind of state of the art. You know, they had very high ceilings, natural light, you know, the blue and white girders, you know, it was all rather cool. But the number of people going through those concourses, which are only maybe 15 to 20 feet wide and sometimes less than that, when you look at where they put the food, beverage, and retail, like Garrett's Popcorn, for example, mm-hmm. and how far TSA sticks out into the concourse, now you've got tens of millions of people going through about 10 feet of space. And, you know, that makes, you know, that's like constantly negotiating the crowds at Mardi Gras in New Orleans. And so that, you know, just need a little bit more space in these airports to get people to be less stressed, and also need space for things like TSA, which there's less than a handful of airports that actually have the space available in which TSA can properly operate. You know, the two that I mention most often are Indianapolis and Buffalo. Both of them winners in the medium category of our airport rankings. And the next one's going to add to that is Midway, which is building a 20, 30,000 square foot TSA dedicated space over the current roadway at Midway. So in order to kind of use the smart lanes and things that TSA has developed, you just need physical space. And that just has not been available in most airports in the United States.
That's a good point. Michael, back to our comparison of sort of the top and the bottom. You know, it does seem that on the surface, Detroit and O'Hare, Metro and O'Hare are alike in a lot of the ways. They're both Midwest airports with similar weather challenges, sort of snow in the winter and thunderstorms in the summer. They're initially kind of similar vintage. They were sort of both part of that second generation of U.S. airports, airfields that were built up during World War II and then moved to commercial service in the early to mid-50s. And they're both major hubs for mainline carriers, Delta for Detroit and United and American for O'Hare. So given these similarities, what is it that Detroit Metro has done differently that makes them tops of the of your traveler satisfaction survey?
Well, when I first started doing the airport study in J.D. Power in 1998, Detroit Metro was near the bottom, and with good reason. Now, if you remember the old terminal, you know,
yes.
It had very low ceilings, had those narrow hallways, I call them hotel hallways, which always gave it, again, like O'Hare currently, had that feeling it was always cramped and there was just tons of people, even though it was slack time sometimes during the day. And I always just say, if you looked at the ceiling, if you ever looked up at that ceiling, you know, which was moldy and black. I mean, it was like,
I remember that.
Yeah. I mean, if you ever looked up, you know, the people do it, they spend more time. As they spend more time in a terminal, if they're delayed and things like that, they tend to look in the corners and the cleanliness of the airport goes down because they just have time to examine it. And eventually they do actually look up. It's one of the last things they actually behaviorally do. And so that feeling was rather gross.
Yes.
Anyway, but what they've been able to do is, you know, they obviously, you know, built a brand new terminal. They have a midfield terminal as well. They have a people mover. But, you know, as I tell all of our clients and also anybody else in the media, there are two ways to build an airport. One is for people and one is for planes. And if you look at, for example, the classic example is Atlanta, which is a transfer hub airport for Delta. And that's the major purpose of that airport. And all their buildings are oblong boxes because it's easy to move the aircraft around and off those gates and get two gates as well. The ideal structure for an airport is actually an X, you know, where you check in on a land side, you get on a people mover, and you land, end up in the middle of an X, which is basically a mall. And that's somewhat the experience we see in other airports that do really well, like Dallas Love Field. When you get through security, it's basically you're looking at a mall and, oh, there's 22 gates parked on the other side of this mall. So that's the feeling that everybody is kind of moving towards. And the thing that they found out in the 20 years or so of this kind of trend is they can make more money if they make it look like a look and feel like a mall, that people are willing to spend more money for unique experiences, unique foods, foods you can't get in other places. And that's something certainly that O'Hare, I know, has plans to incorporate, is more of those Chicago-style restaurants. And, you know, they also ought to be a little bit more authentic, because at O'Hare, you know, they have the Berghof, a place I used to frequent, and there's no German food on the menu at the Berghof at O'Hare, which seems to be kind of a waste of a brand name.
Yeah.
But they have plans to improve all that, in addition to, you know, making the physical structure better. But Detroit Metro, you know, it's, you know, they're a little bit farther out from town. They're a little less restricted in the space they've got. They got a little bit more acreage, certainly not as much as, say, DFW does, but they do have some space to kind of, you know, give the passenger room to breathe and negotiate the airport campus. And the big thing that allowed them to jump up in the rankings this year, you know, they've been near the top in the last several years, but what allowed them to get that number one spot was that the construction on 94 actually got finished, which is the major artery that goes to that airport. And that made people get into the airport quicker. It's, you know, TSA seems a lot more reasonable when you've got time on your hands. And now you can shop for food, beverage, and retail, which is something they've also enhanced at Detroit Metro as well. And so those are the combination. But again, you know, they're going to be starting some new construction projects which will impact access to that airport. So again, we're going to see this kind of churn at the top and bottom of these rankings.
Interesting. One question. When I think about Detroit Metro and O'Hare, and I mentioned it a little bit earlier, does the rankings, the traveler satisfaction rankings, do the operational performance of those hub carriers contribute to traveler satisfaction? I mean, certainly Delta has been in the top tier of operational performance, certainly for the past couple of years, while American and United have struggled. American just announcing this week another big executive shakeup. So given that Delta's doing well and they're the major player in Metro, in Detroit Metro, American and United have struggled, and they certainly are the major players in O'Hare. Does that have any impact on the traveler satisfaction ranking?
It does somewhat. We do obviously see that when you're delayed in your flight, that affects your satisfaction, not only with the airport, but with the airline itself. But there's the definition of late is 15 minutes. And that's not, you know, there's some debate, and we're looking into how late is late. Mm-hmm. So if you're off the gate and more than 15 minutes, you're considered to be late, and that impacts your FAA reported score. But that, you know, if your average is 16 minutes of the late flights, that's not bad. If it's 2 hours, then it certainly is. Cancellation of flights is obviously the biggest disruptor. You got to change your entire plans around that. But we don't see that on-time performance really affecting the way people view the airport, because the better ranked airports give you something to do while you're, you know, in the airport.
Entertainment value.
And also, those airlines that have great in-flight entertainment, like JetBlue and Alaska Airlines, you know, when you're delayed for 15, 20 minutes on the tarmac because of the FAA grounding your particular flight, you know, if you're watching that episode of Friends or an episode of Game of Thrones, you know, the time passes much more quickly. So there's a real crossover. You know, you can be late, but you won't have irate passengers because, hey, I can watch another episode of my favorite TV show. And just sitting here and enjoying the in-flight entertainment. So the actual operation of the airline itself and the things that they offer in flight has a big impact on how people actually feel emotionally about being delayed. So if you can sit at a restaurant or have an interesting cocktail or having, a Texas beef burger that you can sit and enjoy while your flight is delayed, that helps with the satisfaction of the airport.
That
and
makes,
we've seen that more and more in our rankings.
That makes sense. Michael, one last question. What does the frequent traveler have to look forward to in 2020? And you've mentioned a couple of things here, but how do you think these satisfaction scores are gonna come out next September?
Ooh, I'm always loath to predict things because half the time I'm wrong. That's just a statistical average there. But we're gonna see a bigger churn. So some of the major airports, Los Angeles, for example, is going to be the biggest change. Even though they're at the bottom of the rankings, they're going to probably get even worse.
Sure, especially with that announcement of now taking buses for rideshare
Uber
and taxis.
And
yeah, that's going to be ugly.
Yeah, well, in addition to that, they're going to put that people mover over Century Boulevard, and they're going to take out a parking lot or two or three. They haven't really settled on how many parking lots they're going to destroy to make this thing. But that's right in the very heart of that horseshoe shape of the airport.
Yes.
Which is the absolute worst design. Way back when, nobody ever thought that this many million people would be trying to go through LAX. But that's what happens. And then, plus, it's a car culture down there. People want to go door to door. And so we see in the rankings that when you have a ordinance that says, that the TNCs can't drop you off in front of the actual door that you want to get into the airport, satisfaction goes way down, mm-hmm. And Cleveland is an excellent example of that. They now have the people dropped off. They actually drive past the airport door, the actual terminal building, and dropped off like 100, 200 yards away. And now you're walking back through the rain and snow sometimes, or the heat of Cleveland, and you were expecting when you got that Uber or Lyft reservation, you're going to have door-to-door service. I'm going to walk out of my door, and I'm going to walk into the door I want to go into. But, there's just so many people trying to access the airport that the airports have been kind of left little choice but to make these changes. And they will definitely have an impact on satisfaction because no one likes to walk an extra 300 yards because there's too many people, on the frontage.
Michael Taylor, Travel Intelligence Lead for J.D. Power. Michael, thanks very much for joining us on the Travel Commons podcast. This has been it's been a great discussion. Thank you very much.
You're quite welcome.
So thanks again to Michael for taking the time to talk to us. If you want to dig into the study yourself, check out the show notes for a link to the study summary that's posted up on the J.D. Power website. Okay, that's it. That's the end of Travel Commons podcast number 156. I hope you all enjoyed the show. I hope you decide to stay subscribed, or better yet, tell someone else to subscribe. Check out the show notes for music links and, like I said, that link to the J.D. Powers study. You can find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, TuneIn. You can tell Alexa to play the Travel Commons podcast. iTunes or whatever Apple is calling it now that they blew it away with the new Mac OS Catalina upgrade, and actually on Spotify too. The links along with the RSS feeds are on the right-hand side of the Travel Commons website under the heading Subscribe. Right below that in the social media section are links to the Travel Commons Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram feeds. If you've already subscribed to one of these numerous links, appreciate it if you'd leave us a review on one of those sites. And hey, if you check out the Travel Commons Instagram page, you can sort of click through to highlights from the summer's trips to Budapest and Ireland. And actually, if you follow the Travel Commons Instagram page, you'll probably be able to catch some pics and an Instagram story from next week's trip through the Baltics. And as always, if you've got a story, thought, comment, gripe, the voice of the traveler, send them along, text or audio file, comment, COMMENTS, travelcommons.com, and Peacock on Twitter, write them on the Travel Commons page on Facebook, the Travel Commons Instagram site, or post them on the website at travelcommons.com. Thanks to everyone who has taken time to send in emails, tweets, post comments on the website. And until we talk again, after I get back from the Baltics. So until then, take care, and thanks for stopping by the Travel Commons. Bye now.